This is Jeffrey Sachs coming to you from the Tradition World Headquarters recording studio, which doubles as my mamad, my safe room, which has seen a lot of action these last few days during our current crisis with Iran. The conversation we're bringing you now was recorded before this new phase of the war began. We just thought you should know that editorial decisions aren't completely obtuse, nor are they made in a vacuum. Visit traditiononline.org for the very many archived print items and digital content we've produced that speak more directly to Israel's struggles at this time. This episode features a fascinating conversation about current scholarship on Maimonides, the Great Eagle. Tradition's winter issue presented a review essay by Mark Herman on Professor Mordechai Akiva Friedman's Harambam Ugnizat Kahir, Maimonides and the Cairo Gniza, and Rabbi Dr. Aaron Adler's Al Kanfei Nisharim, Mechkarim B'Sifrut Hilchatit Shel Harambam. In this podcast, reviewer meets his subject, as Herman and Aaron Adler discuss aspects of their common work on Maimonides. Among other topics, they consider differences in approach to Maimonidean research carried out by pure academicians, as opposed to a rabbinic educator who dabbles in academia and benefits from its methods, and how Rav Adler synthesized traditional yeshiva-style learning with academic tools in his book. They also speculate about whether or not and how the academic approach, utilizing the vast manuscript material available today, could or should make its way in traditional study in Bate Midrash. Rabbi Dr. Aaron Adler is a veteran communal leader, educator, and scholar. He is Rabbi Emeritus at Ohel Nechama in Jerusalem and founding Rosh Yeshiva at Bnei Akiva's Yeshivat Ner Tamid in Chashmonaim. Mark Herman is an assistant professor at York University in Toronto. His first book, After Revelation, The Rabbinic Past in the Medieval Islamic World, will be published in the coming weeks by the University of Pennsylvania Press. You can read Mark's Maimonides in Panoramic View, New Studies of the Great Eagle, from Tradition's Winter 2025 issue at traditiononline.org.
There's much that we still have to learn about the Rambam. This might be a surprise to people who are outside of the Beit Midrash or outside of the academy, but it turns out that even the greatest of medieval Jews has much still to teach us and much we can still learn about his life and how he worked and his legacy. Today, I want to get a sense of Rabbi Adler's work and Rabbi Adler himself and talk about some of the big questions it raises about Maimonidean studies and more broadly even about the relationship of what between the traditional levels of study, the Beit Midrash, and the academy and the university itself. As we will see, hopefully in today's interview, Rabbi Adler's volume and Rabbi Adler's work really brings together the best of the Beit Midrash and the academy to show exactly how much combining different methodologies can teach us about the Rambam. So my first question before we delve into Rabbi Adler's volume is if you could give us the elevator pitch to this work. You know, what does it do, particularly what is new about it, and how you did this kind of work, how you arrived at this research, and how you went through doing this really copious research.
Thank you, Mark, Professor Herman. And this is a great honor to be with you on this podcast. You know, the 1954, when the academic and even some of the Torah world brought to everybody's attention the 750th year of the passing of the Rambam, so our great Rebbe of Soloveitchik, the Rav, commented, "I never knew that the Rambam died." And we have to understand that the Rambam is alive and well, kicking, as you mentioned, both in the world of Beit Midrash as well as in the halls of academia. There's the irony that Rambam believed that if you just read the Tanakh, the full Bible, and read my book, the Mishneh Torah, there would be no need for subsequent writings in the world of the oral law. And yet, more books have been written on the Mishneh Torah of the Rambam in the world of oral law than any other book, which is, and we're still writing. And whatever we're going to do, it's just going to be incomplete, and we just have to carry on. My days go back in the study days, intense study days, to the 1970s when I was at the Yeshiva University and studying by our great Rebbe the Rav. And there, of course, we're getting a take on how to deal with Rambam from the methodology of the Rav's grandfather, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik from Brisk, and that became known in the yeshiva world as the Briska Derech, a particular way of analysis of dealing with contradictions in Rambam texts, which usually meant a type of splitting of hairs, trying to explain that Rambam meant one thing in one place and another thing in another place. And this became a type of fortified method that's been carried down to students of this particular methodology. The Rav was a great orator, was a great presenter of material, and hence he attracted so many hundreds and even thousands of students. But concurrently with my learning with the Rav in his shiur, I also did my master's thesis at the Berman Revel Graduate School of Yeshiva University, and came in contact with Rabbi Professor Meir Simcha Feldblum. At that time, he was the basic person in the Talmud department of the graduate school. And my proposed thesis for the master's was precisely what became the seeds of ultimately the book that develops over 36 years later. The idea of looking into contradictions between the Mishnah commentary of the Rambam and the Mishnah Torah. So many people are aware of the fact that there are such contradictions, and usually with regard to the Mishnah commentary that was written when the Rambam was between age 23 and 30, and comparing it to the later work of the Rambam between age 35 and 45, the Mishnah Torah, you can assume that human beings change their minds. And the change of mind, which is such a natural thing, which shows that Rambam was dynamic and was not locked into a particular point of view of 10 or 20 years earlier, usually the solution is developed ad hoc in a local situation. Let's examine the particular subject and let's see what went through his mind logically that caused this change. But I became exposed to the works of Professor Shaul Lieberman, the Hilchot HaYerushalmi of the Rambam. Now, just to take a moment, many people, even in the yeshiva world, have never heard of this book, even though the Rambam mentions it in his Mishnah commentary to Masechet Tamid and in one of his responsum. So the Hilchot HaYerushalmi is actually a Yerushalmi parallel to what Rabbi Yitzhak Alfasi, the Rif, does for the Babylonian Talmud. And that is to have a type of filtering out of the discussion, the Talmudic discussion, filtering out of Agadic material, and just presenting the headline of the subject at hand with the bottom line. And this was a major contribution of the Rif, Rabbi Yitzhak Alfasi, to the Talmud Bavli. Nothing parallel existed with the Yerushalmi. And the Rambam decides to actually fulfill the mission of publishing, of putting out such a work, Hilchot Yerushalmi. The problem is it wasn't copied sufficiently enough, and it got lost. And it was only rediscovered in the Cairo Geniza. And there was Professor Lieberman, 1947, who positively identifies two fragments, just on Masechet Brachot and on Masechet Ketubot, that this comes from the original work of the Rambam, and it was actually the autograph of the Rambam. Rambam's handwriting, where you have his erasures, crossing out lines, writing in the marginal comments, and you get to see the Rambam in his laboratory, and what he's doing, and how he's thinking. And Professor Lieberman has a lengthy introduction to this Hilchot HaYerushalmi that takes us back to the Mishnah commentary. And that really triggered the whole discussion. And I realized that we're not talking about one or two or three isolated cases of Rambam changing his mind, but we're talking about something that is going to have to be dealt with much more extensively to bring out the numbers. And what ultimately helped was the translation of the Rambam's Parash HaMishnah, the commentary of the Mishnah, which was written originally in Judeo-Arabic. But the addition of Rav Yosef Kapach, the great Yemenite Dayan, between 1963 and 67, publishes this new Hebrew translation of Rambam's Mishnah commentary with very nice footnoting, telling us when the Rambam changed his mind, because he, Rabbi Kapach, is working with a whole different slew of manuscripts showing earlier versions of what the Rambam wrote and later versions. And usually the later version of the Mishnah commentary correlated with the Mishnah Torah. So what I did was I started accumulating the data, And I realized that we're talking about almost 750 changes between the Mishnah commentary and the Mishneh Torah. Some of the changes are in commentary itself, how Rambam understood a Talmudic idea or concept, and some of them have to do with halakha, with the exact decision of halakha. Rambam changes his mind in the halakha by having a particular approach early and then subsequent approach later. There was one of the greats of the, I believe, 16th century, Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi, who many of us just know him as a commentator on Rashi on the Chumash, but he was also a posek. He wrote, there is Shelot to Tshuvot, his response to literature. And he deals with about four or five illustrations that he came up with of Rambam changing his mind between Mishnah commentary and the Mishneh Torah, and notices that in all of those five cases, the Rambam becomes more strict. He moves from a more lenient opinion to a more strict opinion. Now, that's on the basis of five cases. In my studies, when I was always keeping my eye on the direction of the change from leniency to strict, it turns out that it's approximately 50-50, that half the time the Rambam is going one way and half the other, which means that after you've accumulated so much data, you can make such a judgment. You can't make a judgment after five cases. But if you're looking at hundreds of cases and you're seeing that it's working in both directions, I think it was 48% to 52%, but it's 50-50, which means that humra kula, leniency, strictness, has no bearing whatsoever in this discussion. That's what it means. That's a conclusion. That's very, very, very important. I did finish my master's thesis in 1976 at BYU. And then my family, we went on Aliyah in 1979. I put everything on hold. In 1983, I went to Bar-Ilan University. And there, I entered into the doctoral program under the tutelage of Rav Professor Shlomo Zalman Havlin, one of the great Rambam experts of the day. And there we simply, not simply, we expanded exactly what I started in the master's level and brought it into different spheres of research. And I was very, very happy that I had the guidance of both Professor Fogelman and Professor Havlin, because they were giants in this particular field. And I realized that we can use this information that's being brought out from academic research and applied to traditional yeshiva learning. I can give examples.
In a couple minutes. That's great. That sounds like that's really helpful, I think, for me, who's read the book very closely, and for our listeners who may not have done so yet, to get a sense of what the book is trying to do and how you did it. It's really quite a remarkable feat of stamina, I would say, to even just identify, let alone categorize, these 750 kinds of changes. So the bulk of the book, Al Kanfei Nesharim, is divided into five themes, thematic suggestions as to how the Rambam changes mind, or why the Rambam changed his mind. So maybe you could introduce the reader to a couple of the themes and reflect a little bit on how confident we can be in doing this kind of work, sort of working backwards and trying to get insert ourselves, if we can, into a great mind. Obviously with 750 cases, you're dealing with really cumulative evidence, right? Any one case, as you mentioned, in the example of the Mizrahi, if five cases is not going to be enough. But through the systematic approach, you've really been able to show something much more, I think, compelling. So perhaps you could tell us a little bit about these themes and how you reflect on them methodologically as well.
Okay, so first of all, the book carries 14 chapters, and that's because my wife Miriam suggested to me that if you're going to write about the Rambam, you ought to have 14 chapters. And I actually do have a chapter on the significance of the number 14, the unknown 14th principle of faith. That's an idea developed by Rav Nachum Rabinowitz and Rabbi Sachs and others who've given some thought to a 14th principle. But anyway, two-thirds of the book, and that is five chapters of the 14, deal with this particular issue of Rambam changing his mind from the early versions of the Mishnah commentary to the later versions and the Mishneh Torah. The first and foremost was the approach to Talmud Yerushalmi. Now, everybody knows, it's so axiomatic, that Rambam, beyond his predecessors and those who came after, were more engaged in Yerushalmi than anybody else. It was said by the Ravid, Rabbi Avram ben David, says it, Darko shel Rabbeinu. It's said all the way to Rabbi Kiva Eger and until this very day. Everybody knows. That's not a chidush. There's no news there. But it was pointed out by a professor, Michael Goodman, in the 1920s, that when one studies the Mishnah commentary and using the accepted klalei psika, the principles of decision for deciding upon a dispute between A and B, and we have a listing of principles of decision, that Rambam was very, very attached to those principles of decision, but later he moved away from some of them because of Yerushalmi influence or impact. Now that was very illuminating for me. And then I went to Rav Lieberman in his Hilchot Yerushalmi, where he shows that there were some entries in this Hilchot Yerushalmi that did not exist in his early Mishnah, Perasha Mishnah, which means he's moving with time to adopting the Yerushalmi. So I'm using I didn't deal with 750 cases. I dealt with about a third of them in the book, which is significant, about 250 cases. And within the world of the Yerushalmi, I'm talking about nearly 100 cases where Rambam says what he says in one place, and there's a change. And the change can only be explained by citing the Yerushalmi to give it backing. Now, how does this all begin? It begins with Rambam talking in his responsa literature. Now, usually the Rambam in the Mishneh Torah, as we know, doesn't tell us what his sources are. He got into some trouble early in life by this. But in the responsa, when he's asked, he sometimes does come around and tell us that it's the Yerushalmi that was the reason. I'll give an example. The Rambam has a Mishnah in Masechet Bikurim that talks about a convert, a ger, who has to bring the Bikurim to Beit HaMikdash, the first fruits of the seven species of fruits of Eretz Israel, and he has to read a section. It's four or five verses from Parshat Ki Tavo. The Mishnah says, ger mevi ve'eino korei. The ger does not, the convert does not read this because he cannot say the word avoteinu, my forefathers, he wasn't there. There is no arguments in the Mishnah, which is called the Stam Mishnah. And there's a principle that says, halakha kistam Mishnah. If there's an anonymous Mishnah with no dispute in there, the halakha is in accordance with that Stam Mishnah, unless otherwise indicated in the Gemara, in the Talmud itself. We get Bavli or Yerushalmi, whatever. There has to be some type of indication. But the Masechet Bikurim has no Talmud Bavli. It's simply ger mevi ve'eino korei. In his original version of the Perush HaMishnah, the Mishnah commentary, Rambam says, kol ze barur, upashut. It's just simple. It's a simple matter. It's straightforward. And that's it. You walk away with it, understanding that the halakha is ger mevi ve'eino korei, because he tells us already in his introduction that if there's an anonymous Mishnah, I don't have to tell you each time this is in accordance with the halakha. So that's an accepted thing. But later in life, the Rambam says, ella, but the psak halakha is actually the reverse. The psak halakha is that the ger mevi ve'korei, the ger does read the section, because the ger, the convert, is a descendant of Abraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu was the universal father. And therefore, he can read the section. And that's how the Rambam writes in the Mishneh Torah as well, and so on. But we still don't know where he has this idea from until he's asked a question by a local convert, the name of Ovadia Hager. And the question was about the tfilot. Elokeinu v'lokei avoteinu, sha'asan nisim la'avoteinu. The word avoteinu shows up in many of our prayers, many of our brachot. So how does the ger to approach this? And the Rambam tells us,
how does he refer to our forefathers, but he's not genetically?
But he's not. He wasn't there. He's a hitchhiker. He came on board later in Jewish history. And the Rambam tells us, and he tries to tell this Ovadia Hager, you're on board with us from day one, because Avraham Avinu was your father. and you have a portion in everything of the covenant that we, the Jewish people, have with Abraham. And he says, and you know what? And therefore, he says, in your tefillot, you say, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Sha'aseh Nisim L'avoteinu, just like any other Jew. And the proof is Bikurim. And he goes back to this Mishnah, and he doesn't tell us that he changes his mind. He gives us the updated version, and he says, because in the Yerushalmi, there is another opinion there, and it's the opinion of a Rabbi Yehuda, a Tana, so it's a Braita, it's a parallel to a Mishnah, but it's a Braita. And Rabbi Yehuda says, Ger mevi v'kore, and the Yerushalmi says that they, in fact, held lehalacha in accordance with that halacha on a practical level. That was so decided. And the Rambam says, this is the halacha. So you see that in this particular responsum, he's banking on the Yerushalmi as his source for what we know now is a changed opinion. So this is important. And there are other times in the Mishnah commentary itself where he will cite a Yerushalmi. And you see that that becomes, and that was the additional material in the Mishnah commentary, which means he says something originally, it does not include the Yerushalmi citation. His later add-on does include the Yerushalmi citation. Now, we have to be clear here. The Rambam was an expert in Yerushalmi from day one. And there are issues in the Yerushalmi that do not appear at all in the Babylonian Talmud. And the Rambam feels that those are halachically acceptable as well. This he has already from the Rif, Rabbi Yitzchak Afasi, going all the way back to Rav Haigon. This was known that if there's something in the Yerushalmi that does not appear in the Talmud Bavli, in the Babylonian Talmud, we can accept it anyway. Just one good example, not eating matzah on Erev Pesach does not appear in the Bavli, but it only appears in the Yerushalmi, and on day one, the Rambam has this. What I'm talking about is using the Yerushalmi as a tool to be decisive in a dispute where, in accordance with the Bavli, you would go one way, but now with the Yerushalmi add-on, you might take that dispute another way. Now, that doesn't mean that Rambam always gave Yerushalmi precedence. It means that the Rambam, with time, upgraded the status of Yerushalmi to a level that was way beyond that was ever done previously, and I dare say, even after the Rambam as well.
In that specific case, do you think that there are other, what kind of reasons might there be for the Rambam to have done so? Do you think it was a polemical reasons? Do you think there were historical reasons, institutional reasons? What kind of factors might have gone into sort of upgrading the status of the Talmud Yerushalmi?
Okay, so here I'm going to stick my neck out and say something highly speculative.
It's a podcast. You can do that on a podcast.
Yeah, fair. Fine. And to understand the Rambam's relationship, which wasn't all that positive, with the Torah center of Baghdad of his day. People assume that the Gaonic period comes to an end in the 10th century. And afterwards, we're now what we call the Rishonim, the Middle Age greats. And we will cite Rabbi Yitzchak Afasi, the Rif, and we'll cite the Rambam, of course, and the Ramban, and then in France, Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam. We're in the Rishonim. My great mentor, Professor Havlin, shows that there was about a 200-year overlap between the end of the Gaonic period and the beginning of the Rishonim, which means we now have from the 10th century to the 12th century, both Gaonic period continuing in full operation and the Rishonim in North Africa, Spain, and France and Ashkenaz developing on their own independently. The Gaonim believed they were the Rosh Yeshiva, the great heads of Yeshivot, of Babel, and they were receiving questions from the diaspora. Diaspora meant everywhere else. And they were responding to these questions. And with these questions came donations to the yeshiva. So this was very, very interesting enterprise. What happened when new Torah centers are now developing in North Africa and Spain and in Mainz and Germany, there's no longer a need for the center of Baghdad. And indeed, it starts shriveling up. But the Gaon of Baghdad of the Rambam's day, Shmuel ben Ali, they're still fighting tooth and nail for supremacy. And they believe that they had the handle on the tradition of the Babylonian Talmud. By upgrading Yerushalmi, the Rambam is undermining some of that Gaonic authority of the 12th century. Now, again, the Rambam never says that specifically, but in fact, the Rambam deals a death blow to the Gaonic authority of Baghdad of the day. And that's why Rabbi Havlin believes that the end of the period of the Gaonim is actually the appearance of the Mishneh Torah of the Rambam in the 12th century, because it was a book that encompassed all of the oral Torah teachings up until his day and was accepted by the Jewish people. So that was a definition that Rabbi Havlin used to define the end of a historic period. And no doubt, the use of the Yerushalmi contributed to that weakening of status of the Gaonate of Baghdad in Babel of the day.
That's very, very interesting. As Professor Tversky taught us, right, that when the Rambam is often polemicizing against the Gaonim, right, if one reads, for example, the introduction to the Mishneh Torah, one sees that, you know, the Rambam is sort of commandeering the term Gaon to sort of reduce it of its institutional power, right, and take it away from the contemporary claimants to this title in Baghdad and perhaps elsewhere.
Right. So the Rambam believed that the authoritative status of the oral law ends with the end of the Talmud. And once you enter into the period of the Gaonim, it's an open field. And the Rambam believed wholeheartedly that he was head and shoulders above many, not all, but many of the Gaonim. You have to realize the term Gaon today means one thing. The term Gaon in those days simply meant you were the head of the yeshiva. And right. The fact that you were the head of the yeshiva could have meant that you were a very good administrator and fundraiser, but not necessarily the top Talmud Chacham of the day. So the Rambam challenged many of the Gaonim, and that led me to the next two chapters of the book, because early Rambam, there's a sense that he's locked into Gaonic traditions. But many of the changes are now evidenced by a certain amount of, I would call it, reserved independence from these Gaonic traditions. And that becomes very, very important to show that the Rambam now has separated himself from what was considered the source of tradition of the oral law. And the Rambam says, no, they were not the source, but we can take it back to the days of the Talmud and see, there find our source. But what Rambam ultimately discovers is that there were, and this gets us into the third chapter of the book, there were entries into the Talmudic text in the days of the Gaonim that reflected different ideas of what the Amoraim, the greats of the Gemara, may have originally had in mind in terms of the direction of halakha. Early Rambam was not yet aware of these entries, but later Rambam was aware. He comes to Egypt, and he now has access to material that came from the East. For example, Hilchot Maveh V'Loveh, the 15th chapter, Rambam talks about two specimens of Talmud Bavli that he's holding in his hand that's over 500 years old, which means these are 7th century texts coming from Bavel, and he wants to show that what was known in a particular halakha in his day was wrong, that certain of the Gaonim said something, but now he's looking at Gemarot that were not tampered, let's use that word, tampered yet by Gaonic writings, and therefore he felt free and independent to choose the opinion that he thought was more correct. Now, this procedure was identified by Rav Hai Gaon, that many times the Gaonim would simply scribble on their manuscripts in the margin, and the next copyist thought that that scribble was actually a deleted text by an accidental deleted text. And when they copied the new text, they simply copied the marginal comment into the text. And now we're going to have to sit and try to figure out what was original Talmud and what may have been added on. And that added on material that now is known to Rambam after he arrives in Egypt after age 30 becomes very significant for some of his change decisions.
Fascinating. That's really fascinating. Thank you. That's so great. I hope we're whetting our listeners' appetite to delve more closely into your volume. While we're on the topic, well, we mentioned Professor Tversky a little bit earlier, one of the things that he talks about is polemics, right? A common theme in medieval Jewish writing. And within even legal works like the Mishneh Torah, which is ostensibly a work of just halakha, but really, any student of that work knows that it does much more. What do you think about the claims or the potential contents of polemics within that writing of the Rambam? And how does that impact your methodology and some of the insights that you have here?
So in Rabbi Professor Tversky's monumental work, Introduction to the Mishneh Torah of the Rambam, published, I believe, in 1980. The Hebrew version came out in 1992, and Rabbi Tversky had the good fortune of seeing my doctoral dissertation at that time from Bar-Ilan and incorporated it into the bibliography, and I was deeply honored, believe me. The 1980 version in English, where he talks about polemics in his section of language and style, he very much talks about the fact that Rambam wrote with great brevity in general. However, he would become more verbose when he wanted to ram home a point usually against somebody in particular. So Rabbi Tversky certainly believes that there is polemical style in some of the writings. I believe it can show up in a variety of ways. For example, we know that there's a dispute amongst the greats in counting of mitzvot. The saying of Hallel on a Yom Tov, is that part of the 613 or not? Rambam does not include it at all. He categorically sees Hallel not only for Hanukkah, but also for Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot, and Hallel Yom Ha'atzmaut, but Yom Rambam didn't know that yet, as a rabbinic add-on. Now, Rambam had a choice to talk about Hallel in the laws of Tfilah. He could have talked about it in the laws of Yom Tov. He opts to talk about all of the laws of Hallel within the category of the laws of Hanukkah. And I believe he does that because he wants to make it absolutely clear that as you know that Hanukkah is a rabbinic add-on, so is Hallel. And it's just a rabbinic add-on. Because the Rambam could have written about Hallel elsewhere. And that's important. Or in that very section of Hanukkah, Rambam actually forges together two rabbinic festivals, Purim and Hanukkah, and it's called Hilchot Megillah v'Hanukkah. And as we have in every section, the Rambam tells us exactly how many commandments he's going to be talking about in that particular unit, be it biblical, be it rabbinic. So in with regard to the laws of Megillah and Hanukkah, he says, V'yesh b'hem shtei mitzvot midivrei sofrim, there are two rabbinic mitzvot here. That would be good enough. And then he says, Ve'eino min ha-minyan, they're not part of the counting. Now, if you know that both the Halachot Gedolot and Rabbi Sadia Gaon incorporated into the scheme of 613, the reading of Megillah and Purim and the lighting of Hanukkah candles, and you realize why the Rambam added the phrase, Ve'eino min ha-minyan, no, this is not part of the count. It is rabbinic. He's hammering home that point. But the Rambam will also use redundancies. He'll repeat things. In the laws of Tefillah, in the seventh chapter, he talks about the idea of saying a bracha before Torah study. And he says that before Torah study, you have to make three brachot, and the three brachot are A, B, and C, v'tzivanu al divrei Torah, which is the version of the Rambam, unlike the Ashkenazi, la'asok v'divrei Torah, v'tzivanu al divrei Torah. And the second bracha is ha'arevna Hashem Elokeinu, and ends with, as we have in our print, Hamalame Torah Lamo Yisrael, and you have the third bracha, Asher Bachavanu Mikolamim. Three brachot, okay, fine. The next line, the Rambam says, every single day you are to read, say, recite these three brachot. Why does he repeat the idea that it's three brachot? It turns out that there's actually a dispute between the Ashkenazi sources and the Sephardi sources about a letter Vav, a conjunction Vav HaChibur. Is it Ha'arevna Hashem Elokeinu or V'Ha'arevna Hashem Elokeinu? The Rambam believes there is no Vav there. It's an independent bracha, and it adds up to three brachot. And because the Rambam most probably was aware of the dispute, the Rambam says, there are three. Did you hear me correctly? It's three brachot. And he says it over there. Now, our great Rebbe, the Rav, has a beautiful drasha on why the Rambam repeats that every day you have to say the three brachot, the Birkat HaTorah. And the Rav said that the Rambam's teaching us, and this is classic brisk methodology, two different halachot. Halacha number one is that prior to Torah study, you ought to say a bracha. That's fine. The or brachot, in plural. But there's another halacha. that even if you didn't plan to study Torah today, on a daily basis, you have to say these three brachot. And then, because you're saying these three brachot, you have to have a minimal Torah expression and exposure after the saying of these three brachot. As an independent halakha, don't go by the day without some measure of Torah study. And you're going to be forced to have some minimal Torah study because there's an obligation on a daily basis to say these three brachot. So what the Rav did was he separated the first comment of the Rambam, teaching us that before Torah study, you have to make three brachot, just like before eating, you have to say a certain bracha. And the second halacha was, don't go by any particular day without reciting these three brachot. Now, here, I have the Rav's tradition. It's a wonderful idea. And I'm not contradicting him, but I'm suggesting that perhaps the Rambam repeated it because there was a known dispute on this, and he's ramming home the point that it's actually three brachot. Now, this particular illustration shows up in another chapter in the book, and that has to do with Ashkenaz versions in the printed Mishneh Torah of the Rambam. And this is fascinating because when we study Mishneh Torah, we know that the Rambam will be speaking about brachot and hilchot, the laws of brachot, tefillah. So he's going to give us versions. He even gives us at the end of the book of Ahava his whole siddur. So you get an idea of what the Rambam's davening, his tefillot, look like in his opinion. And more often than not, when we read this in the standard print of Rambam, that is the standard Vilna Varsha print that 95% of us have it at home, whoever bought a set of Rambam, you're going to read, you're probably going to miss the point. You're going to read and nothing's going to faze you because it's brachot that we're familiar with. When you open up such a Rambam, it's going to read V'harevna Hashem Elokeinu. The Vav is printed in. And it's going to read Baruch Ata Hashem Hamlamei Torah Lamo Yisrael. That's the way it's going to read. Yet, if you go through all the manuscript evidence of the Rambams that we have today, and we do have, if it's in Rav Kapach's version of the Mishneh Torah, Rav Nochum Rabinowitz's version of the Mishneh Torah with his Yad Pshuta commentary, with Rav Yitzchak Shilat's version of the Mishneh Torah, Rambam Meduyak, they all have Ha'arev Na Hashem Elokeinu, because we happen to have a manuscript of the first two books of the Mishneh Torah, the Hamada and Ava, that sitting in Cambridge, in Oxford Library, and you can go see it, but you don't have to do that. You can put it online in the Friedberg Geniza project, and you can see it. You can see the Rambam never wrote a Vav. So the print, what happened was, when the printers set the typeset years ago in the early ways of printing books, the printers also had their brachot in the mind. They neglected to look at every letter of the manuscript that they were now setting to print, and they simply took the easy way out and printed the versions of the tefillot or brachot that they themselves knew in their minds in Europe, which was Ashkenazi versions. And that's why they printed Hamalamei Torah Lamo Yisrael. Rambam was actually asked about that, and he says, no. God gave us the Torah. He didn't teach us the Torah. We are supposed to study and teach Torah. So the bracha ends with Baruch Ata Hashem Noten HaTorah. God is the giver of the Torah. That's all. So the Rambam tells us exactly what the ending of that bracha is. And yet in the standard prints, it's wrong. It's the Ashkenazi version.
It's really rich. And it shows you just the level of detail that you've done and the big pictures that you can draw from such close study. Sort of taking a step back a little bit further from the book, what other kinds of unknown ideas or little known ideas do you think you can come up with and find and develop in this volume and in this kind of study?
So we know that the Rambam based his style and language of the Mishneh Torah on the language and style of the Mishnah. That's not a novelty. He says it in the opening of his introduction of his Mishneh Torah. He actually shows similar historic relevance for writing the Mishnah in the days of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi and writing the Mishneh Torah in his own day 1,000 years later. He almost sees himself as the updated Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. He sees himself. And it's not an accident that he calls the Mishnah Mishneh. He calls the book Mishneh Torah. He uses the same word as Mishnah. And it's the style. but it goes even beyond style. It's, I believe it has to do with editorial policy, and this is what I'm going to say is very novel. We know that in while the Mishnah divides into six orders, and then each order has its number of Masechtot, Rambam completely moved away from that. He's got 14 different units in his own idea. But each unit has a certain number of chapters. When we study Mishnah, what is the smallest section, Masechet, of Mishnah in terms of number of chapters? There is no such section that just has chapter 1 and 2. It must necessarily have chapter 1, 2, and 3. If there's no third chapter, then the material was grafted upon a different tractate. That's the way Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi worked. We have some examples of three chapters, Masechet Chagiga, Masechet Orla, Masechet Makot. There are a handful of examples of three chapter. Of course, yeah, more than three. But what's the greatest number? The greatest number is 30. And the one example, obvious example, is Masechet Kelim. It goes to Perek Lamed. There is no such thing as Perek Lamed Aleph. There's no 31st chapter in the Mishnah. The second example could be Baba Kama, Baba Metzia, Baba Batra, which Chachamim say, Kula Nezik and Chada Mesichta, that these threes, Baba Kama, Baba Metzia, Baba Batra, means the first gate, the middle gate, the last gate, was one big hefty tractate that was divided into three because it was pretty heavy. And it is divided equally to 10 chapters each, which means it's also a 30-chapter tractate. Those are the limits, 3 to 30. Now you go back to the Mishneh Torah of the Rambam, and guess what? There is no section that's less than 3 chapters and no section more than 30 chapters. It's the exact same limits. And I can't believe that that's an accident, that the Rambam must probably have this in mind. The section of 30 happens to be the laws of Shabbat. It goes to Perek Lamed. And the section of 3, you have several. Hilchot Chagiga is 3 and so on. But if the Rambam only had 2 chapters of material, like the laws of the Birkat Kohanim, he cannot have Birkat Kohanim sit independently. So he attaches this as a type of maftir to the laws of Tefillah. So the 14th and 15th chapter of the laws of Tefillah become the laws of Nesiat Kapayim. And that's what, and that's why the Rambam connects Megillah and Hanukkah, where he only has 2 chapters for each. So he forges them together because there are other reasons, conceptual reasons to bind the two, no doubt. But Megillah as 2 chapters cannot stand alone, and Hanukkah cannot stand alone. And the Lulav has 2 chapters. It cannot stand alone. It's together with Sukkah, but that makes sense anyway. But it's true.
That's very, very interesting. No, it's nice to be able to think big picture in this material and really see the models that, you know, subtly, without declaring necessarily, that the Rambam is clearly using. I think it's a great, very suggestive line of reasoning. When we think, more broadly about the project, one of the things that strikes me about this work, and one of the reasons I wanted to review it in tradition, is it sort of brings together different methodologies. You know, you've talked about manuscripts and changing the Rambam's mind, and you've talked about how that sort of contrasts perhaps with the version, the sort of methodology and the insights that you learned before entering the academy. So I think, you know, we are trained today, or we sort of are accustomed to thinking, you know, that the way that the Rambam or other, you know, volumes of Torah are studied in the academy is different than it is studied in a yeshiva, in a Beit Midrash, whatever it might be. And there's certainly lots of truth to that reflection and that presupposition. But at the same time, right, I think we can all think fairly easily, and, you know, your volume is, you know, at front of mind at the moment, but we can think, you know, it's not hard to realize that these disciplines, the individuals that engage in these fields, often, you know, cross paths and cross-fertilize, hopefully. So what do you think about that? I don't know if you prefer to speak from the academic perspective, what the academics could learn from a yeshiva, or the opposite, what the yeshiva can learn from the academy. Think about, you know, just maybe reflect broadly about how these two worlds operate, either within, you know, one figure of Rabbi Dr. Aaron Adler, or, you know, in more broadly speaking, you know, how this kind of study can be done. And specific, you know, even specific examples, you know, we talk about the academy is, you know, constantly talking about manuscripts and variants and different readings and intertextual instability. Whereas, you know, in the Beit Midrash, this is much less of a focus. So maybe you could think, help our listeners or viewers think about that these kind of questions, you know, more broadly.
Okay, I mean, I would take it back even to The author of the Sri Deyesh, Rabbi Chiya Yaakov Weinberg, who I believe was on the same time a tremendous Talmud Chacham and Posek Halakha and a Talmudic scholar in the academic sense. Many people have the three volumes of his responsa literature, She'elot u'Tshuvot, but never looked at volume four, which is his Mechkarim. And there you see him. He could have passed as a professor of Jewish studies in any department. Rav Weinberg writes there in his fourth volume that you have to be immersed in traditional Torah study in order to engage in the academic side, as a necessary prerequisite. He felt that this was almost theologically necessary, that you have this. At Yeshiva University in the 70s, there was a lot of concern for the critical approach to studying of Talmud and so on. There were some of the Rosh Yeshiva who categorized it as heresy and apikorsis and things of this nature. I had a particularly good fortune that as I was working on my master's at the time, I was also the driver of the Rav, and I had opportunity to chat with him about things I was doing at the Bernard Revel Graduate School. And somehow he never threw me out of the car. I was able to survive it. And I spoke later with Rav Lichtenstein, Zichron LeBracha, in the yeshiva in the Gush about with Yerushalmi, and Rav Aaron listened patiently, carefully, and said that I was on something very novel, and he thought that this was something that could be pursued. And I even go further. Just half a year ago, in a visit to the campus of Yeshiva University, where I made a presentation at the Bernard Revel Graduate School of faculty and students on my book, I sat with one of my dear teachers, Rebbe, Rav Herschel Schechter, who's the head of the kollel there at the Yeshiva University. And Rav Schechter was asking me about this book and so on. And he listened carefully, and he said, you know, that I think the yeshiva boys should hear some of these things. That was what I call the modeh b'miktzat, that he was willing to acknowledge that yesh dvarim b'go, there's something here. And all I told Rav Schechter was, you invite me, and I'll be happy to make a presentation here at the Beit Midrash. That will be important, because there is overlap. There's no question there's overlap. All of us, let's say the yeshiva world studying Torah, and what we're doing in the academic halls with regard to Rambam, we're trying to figure out the truth, or as close to the truth as possible, of what the Rambam had in mind. So the goals are identical. And perhaps the methodology may be somewhat different. So you're going to use a conceptual method to try to figure out what was going on in the Rambam's mind, or you're going to try to figure things out textually by doing comparisons of different manuscripts and so on. One can only help the other. But I'll give you a good example of where the scholarly approach most probably can be in great service to the world of halacha. And that came out just this year when we had the calendar of Purim, where the 15th of Adar comes out on Shabbat, as we had this year. And in Yerushalayim, where I sit right now, Purim is held on the 15th of Adar, except that we don't read the Megillah on the 15th of Adar. We read it on the 14th on Friday in this particular case. Upon that, there's no dispute whatsoever. The dispute was in Yerushalayim, when we read the Megillah on the 14th, does it necessarily have to have a minyan of 10? Now, that's a question that the Gemara talks about in general with Megillah. Does Megillah reading on Purim require 10 people? And the Gemara comes to the conclusion it's a dispute, but the halacha is it does not need 10. 10 is a wonderful thing, but you can read it in the privacy of your home, as we all know. We also know that in the days of our Chachamim, when there was an allowance to read the Megillah on the 11th, 12th, 13th of Adar for people not coming to the cities, those pre-readings had to be done with a minyan. That is absolutely clear. The question was, the Yerushalmi population this year on Friday, is it considered a bona fide regular reading and does not need a minyan like every other year? Or is it considered a pre-reading like the 11th, 12th, and 13th and would require a minyan? And there are poskim here in Yerushalayim who gave notice that you have to have a minyan, you can't read the Megillah at home this year, and so on, so on, so on. Okay, I'm not challenging why they're saying what they're saying, except that the Rambam uses a phrase that I have an entire chapter on, the word nimtza. Nimtza means the Rambam is summing up something that seems to be so obvious and so ridiculously obvious, we don't know why the Rambam is adding it up. When the Rambam tells us that Adam HaRishon received six commandments and Noach was added Eber Minachai, and then he says, you know what comes out? Now there's seven. Okay, a first grader can know that too. And when the Rambam says there were 18 brachot of the Amidah, and in the days of Rambam Gamliel and his Beit Din, they added another bracha, now there are 19 brachot. I know there are 19 brachot. And the Rambam in each case is doing this often in the Mishneh Torah. I believe he's doing it in order to forge together a solid unit and saying that the new add-on is part and parcel of what I just said before. It becomes one whole unit. And whatever was correct for the original unit is now correct for the new expanded unit. And the Rambam actually uses such a phrase with regard to the reading of the Megillah in a place like Yerushalayim on Friday, the 14th of Adar. And he says, V'nimtzu, you know what comes out? What comes out is Shahakol Korim Barbasar. Everybody's reading on the 14th. He just said that the line before. He said when the 15th is on Shabbat, so those people will read it on the 14th. And now he reviews it. He said, you know what comes out? The bottom line? The bottom line that everybody's reading it on the 14th. Why is he writing that line at all? If not to tell us that the reading of the Megillah for the Yerushalmi population on Friday on the 14th of Adar is identical to the Tel Aviv people and the New York people and the Toronto people. It's reading it in its time. And if you don't need a minyan in anywhere else, you don't need a minyan on the 14th. Which means that I'm saying that this is a definitive halakha that is extrapolated from the Rambam's use of nimtza. And that was only discovered by a wide sweeping search throughout the Mishneh Torah to identify the Rambam's usage of the word nimtza.
So you've taken this sort of broader methodological comprehensive view and use it to highlight these individual cases where this word appears.
Right? Correct. And it shows up a wonderful example. You know, the introduction to the Mishneh Torah, the Rambam gives us 40 generations from Moshe Rabbeinu to Rav Ashi, the end of the Talmud Bavli. And then he turns it around with a type of parade in the reverse. Says, what comes out is that Rav Ashi from Rava and Rava from and brings us all back to Yeshua and brings us back to Moshe Rabbeinu and brings us back to God. And he says, Nimtza, you know what comes out? That everything is from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Mipi HaGvura. Now, the Rambam didn't have to give us the reverse parade. He gave us all those names previously. And he's willing to write out the names again as a type of parade from Rav Ashi back to Moshe Rabbeinu to put them all into one basket and saying, just as Moshe Rabbeinu received the Torah from Sinai, everything that moves until Rav Ashi is all part of that unbroken chain. And that's why the nimtza is used. So that is important.
Yeah. Thank you. That's great. That's really interesting. So I think we're pushing our limits of time here, but we maybe should just wrap up with one final question. It's actually, you know, I think one of the messages that I try to convey in my review as well is that, you know, at the end of your book, you say, you know, this work is not yet complete, right? There's much more to be done. So maybe you could spend, you know, a couple minutes sort of reflecting and thinking about suggestions that you'll take up or other people can take up and where you see, you know, the next stages in study of Maimonides, you know, both perhaps within the academy and within the yeshiva, and even, you know, how these two things can come together.
Okay, so tam velo nishlam, it's complete but not complete, is the most authentic words in the book. That's not speculation. That is absolute truth, because there's just so much to be done. First of all, I'm happy to see that some people have already delved into the book with critical comments, and that's fair game. You've made some very, very important comments, and others, because we have to fine-tune things, and we have to perhaps filter things out that may be incorrect, and perhaps look at other methods and so on. The only way this is going to make it in the world of Torah is if enough people from the world of Torah engage in scholarly pursuits in the Jewish studies area of academics. I think it might happen. It's going to take time. But slowly but surely, the computer is infiltrating the world of Beit Midrash. People sit in the Beit Midrash with laptops. People do not bring books to their table any longer. They bring up the information online. And once you do that, you now are exposed to things that the previous world of Torah studiers were never exposed to. I think this is going to help for sure. I'm hopeful that my, you know, modest book will be a contribution and even a springboard for others to pick up and take off. I don't see myself in my age publishing another book. I served as a rabbi for 38 years. I was involved in Jewish education all those years. I was busy, and that's why it took 36 years from the doctorate to turn into a book. It wasn't a stroke of particular laziness. There just were other things on my agenda, which were no less important. But on the other hand, I think ultimately contributed to my own scholarly endeavors. My publishing the book at the Herzog College, which I taught for several years in the context of the college, was pointed out to me by the president of the college, Professor Yehuda Brandis, that what they're looking for is Torah, Chinuch, and academia. Torah, education, and academics all merged together. And that's why I found their publishing house, Tfunot, a very, very comforting zone for me for this book, as opposed to other very fine publishing homes that are pure academics. And I'm not there. I wholeheartedly say I'm not there. The book is not a purely academic endeavor. It's also anecdotes with Torah. There are all kinds of homiletical inserts that I throw in the footnotes. Somebody actually commented, you can see that this was written by a shul rabbi, which is, you know, yesh doshim l'shvach v'yesh doshim l'gnai. And obviously, I took it very positively. Yes, it was written by a shul rabbi who also engaged in academic studies here and there. And therefore, it deserves much more attention by people who are going to be involved in the academic world. I believe that manuscript is something that's going to make it early in the game in the yeshiva world because of computer technology. People will seek out, when they have a problematic Rambam, they're going to be able to just open up the computer and see what other Rambam text of that particular halakha exists. And more often than not, that might provide the answer. Instead of simply looking at your standard version of the Warsaw Vilna text and now groping for all kinds of interesting solutions, intellectually gymnastics-based solutions. If you really want to know what the Rambam said, then you better see what he actually wrote. And today we have that ability to do so. I even got a comment that I even quoted in the book from our Rebbe the Rav, and I asked him, why did the Torah greats throughout the last 850 years hardly look at the Mishnah commentary? I mean, it's used here and there, but it's very sporadic. It doesn't come close even to the attention given to the Mishneh Torah. And the Rav said, because they knew it was in translation, and they knew that in translation, you don't always get to see the authentic Rambam. So they weren't sure they were reading Rambam, and therefore they shied away from it. Certainly, if you add that to the complexity of variant readings in the Mishnah commentary, that is also a problem. But now, because we can reconstruct the strata of the commentary of the Mishnah, that becomes more helpful. And I go on to say, in the book that you reviewed from the Friedman brothers, specifically Shama Yehuda Friedman, the use of Geniza fragments of the Mishneh Torah of the Rambam, we can reconstruct now fragments of Mishneh Torah of earlier versions and later versions, which means the Rambam never stopped working even after he finished the book. He kept going back to it and back to it and back to it. And that is going to be, may take 50 years or more, more commonplace in the world of Beit Midrash study.
Well, I can say that I've learned a lot from the book, and that it sits on my desk as I do my own research. And I've certainly benefited a lot, and hope to, and expect to continue to do so in the years to come. So thank you so much for taking the time. I hope this encourages the readers to look at the review, but more importantly, to look at the book and to, you know, get really delve in and contribute to this ongoing discussion that's been going on for 800 years and sees no signs of stopping.
No sign of it.